Chapter 6 Divination by Auto Seance. A Dream. Joining the SN. I lodged a formal complaint with the High Custodian's office, but it was simply for show. Karpel could manufacture serious problems for me if I tried to leave without his agent. I could do that, of course. I could do as I liked. But Karpel could delay me. And I didn't know how much cooperation from the elders and administrations of Hubris I'd need later, if any part of this investigation led to trial. Besides, Karpel knew I was going on to Gudrun, and he would plainly send Fischig there under an RBT's warrant to investigate anyway. On the whole, I decided I'd rather have Chasner Fischig where I could see him. On the afternoon before our intended departure, I had Loewing prepare for an auto seance. I doubted whether anything further could be learned now, but I wanted to cover every avenue. As usual, we used my quarters, with the cabin door locked, and Betancourt strictly instructed to prevent interruptions. I sat in a high-back armchair and spent some quarter of an hour lowering my mind to a semi-trance state. This was an old technique, one of the first I had been taught when my abilities had originally been detected by the tutors of the Inquisition. On a cloth-covered table between us, Loewing laid out key evidence items, some of Eichlone's effects, some other pieces taken from Thorview 12011, and some from the processional. We also had the mysterious casket from the cryogenerator chamber. Once he was satisfied I was ready, Loewing opened his mind to the warp and filtered its raging influence through his highly trained mental architecture. This transitional moment was always a shock, and I shuddered. The temperature in the room dropped palpably, and a glass bowl on a side counter cracked spontaneously. Loewing was murmuring. His eyes rolled back, twitching and jerking slightly. I closed my eyes, though I could still see my room. What I was seeing was a visualization of our surroundings, constructed by Loewing astropathically in the Empyrean itself. Everything shone with a pale blue light from within, and solids became translucent. The dimensions of the room shifted slightly, stretching and buckling as if they had difficulty retaining their coherence. I took up the items on the table, in turn, Loewing's projection enhancing their psychometric qualities, opening my mind's ability to the signatures and resonances they carried in the warp. Most were dull and blunt, with no trace of resonance. Some had wispy tendrils of auras around them, relics of passing contact with human hands and human minds. Eichlone's vox device buzzed with the distant, unintelligible whinings of ghosts, but gave up nothing. Eichlone's pistol stung my hand like a scorpion when I touched it, and both I and Loewing gasped. I had a brief aftertaste of death. I decided not to touch it again. His data slate, which Amos had yet been unable to open, was dripping with a sticky, almost gelatinous aura. The thickness of the psychic residue betokened the complex thought processes and data that had adhered to it. It gave up nothing, and I became frustrated. Loewing amplified my scrutiny, and at last, as a whisper, I landed the word or name, Desumnor. The final item for inspection was the casket. It resonated brightly with flickering bands of warp traces. Our contact with it was necessarily brief because of the exhausting strength of its halo. We probed, opening what seemed to be three levels of psychometric activity. One was sharp and hard and tasted of metal. Loewing averred that this was a relic of the intellect or intellects that had crafted the casket, an undeniably brilliant but malevolent presence. Beneath that, colder, smaller, denser, like a lightless collapsed star, lay a heavy, throbbing trace that seemed to be locked in the heart of the casket's machine core. Around both, fluttering and swooping like birds, were the vestigial psychic agonies of the dead from Processional 212. Their plaintive psychic noise rippled through our thoughts and sapped the emotional strength from us both. The dead souls of the Processional had left their psychic fingerprints on this device that had been instrumental in their murder. We were about to step back and end the seance when the second trace, the cold, distant, dense one, began to well up to the surface. I was intrigued at first, then stunned by its gathering force and speed. It filled my head with a nauseating, intolerable sense of hunger. Hunger, thirst, appetite, craving. It rose from the depths of the casket, wailing and yearning, a dark thing tearing up through the other trace energies. I glimpsed its malice and felt its consuming need. Loink broke the link. He slumped back in his seat, panting, his skin dotted with the stigmatic blood spots of an astropathic augury taken too far. I felt it too. My mind seemed cold, colder even than the ministrations of dormant. It seemed to take a very long time before my thoughts began to flow freely again, like water slowly thawing in an iced pipe. I rose and poured myself a glass of Amasek. I poured one for Loink, too, as an afterthought. Neither of us ever came away from an auto seance feeling good, but this was signally worse than usual.
"There was danger,"
Loink husked at last.
"Vile danger, from the casket."
I felt it.
"But the whole seance was unseemly, Master, as if distracted and spoiled by some factor."
I sighed. I knew what he had felt. "I can explain. The girl we have aboard is an untouchable." Loink shuddered.
"Keep her away from me."
I passed the word De Sumnor to Amos in case it assisted his work on the data slate and rested in my cabin to recover. Loink had gone back to his tiny residence under the cockpit deck. I doubted he would be useful for much for a goodly while. I gathered up the evidence items, rebagged them, and locked them in the cutter's strongbox, all except the casket, which was too big to fit. We kept it bagged and chained in a tarpaulin locker aft. As I hefted it up to return it to the locker, I felt the aftershock of its aura, as if we had woken something, some instinct. I considered this to be the imagination of my stung mind working overtime, but I completed the task only when I had buckled on a pair of work gloves. Betancourt joined me shortly afterwards. He had gone through Vibben's effects and found no will or instructions. Now we needed her cabin to house Fischig, so we placed her belongings and clothes in an underseat store bin in the crew bay, and together carried her wrapped body to the cot in the medical suite. I locked the door as we left.
"What will you do with her?" Betancourt asked. "There's no time to arrange a burial here now."
"She once said she came with me to see what the stars were like. That's where we'll lay her to rest." Then I slept, turning fitfully despite my exhaustion. When sleep finally came, the dreams were cold and inhospitable. Murderously black, backlit clouds rippled in fast motion across skies I didn't know, strobing with electrical flashes. Dark trees and darker, higher walls ranged around the edges of the dream. I felt the instinct, the hunger from the casket, lurking in some blind spot my eyes refused to find. Carrion birds, a flock of them, swooped down from the upper reaches of the sky and took all the colour with them, staining the dream world grey, all except for a spot of red that glittered in the colourless soil ahead of me. With each step I took towards it, it receded. I began to run. It continued to display dream logic and moved away. Finally, gasping for breath, I stopped running. The red spot had gone. I felt the hunger again, but now it was inside me, clawing at my belly, filling my throat with craving. The roiling clouds overhead froze suddenly, motionless, even the lightning flares stilled and captured in jagged, phosphorescent lines. A voice spoke my name. I thought it was Vibben, but when I turned, there was nothing to see except the suggestion of a presence drifting away like smoke. I woke. From the clock, I had been asleep only a couple of hours. My throat was raw and my mouth dry. I drained two glasses of water from the side cabinet and then fell back on the bed. My head ached, but my mind would not stop spinning. After that, no sleep came at all. The Voxlink chimed about 4 hours later. It was Betancourt.
"The SN has just made orbit," he told me. "We can leave whenever you like."
The SN lay slantwise above the inverted bowl of Hubris, silhouetted against the stars. We had left the radiance of the sun dome into a blizzard squall. The airframe of the cutter had vibrated wildly as Betancourt lifted us out of the clutches of the ferocious icy winds until we were riding clear over an ocean of frosty vapour. The blizzard, a sculptural white continent, then dropped away below, until we could see its tides and gusts and currents, the wide centrifugal patterns of its titanic force.
There,
Betancourt had said, with a nod to the raked front ports. Even at 90 kilometres, still rising through the thinning aeropores, he had made visual contact. It had taken me a few more moments to find it. A bar of darkness distorting the pearly edge of the plane sphere. Another minute, and it had become a three-dimensional solid. A minute more, and I began to resolve the running lights glittering on its surface. Yet another minute, and it filled the ports. It resembled some colossal tower that had been ripped away from its earthly foundations and set adrift, tranquil, in the void.
A beauty,
murmured Betancourt, who appreciated such things. His inlaid hands flicked over the flight controls, and we yawed to the correct approach vectors. The gun cutter and the massive vessel exchanged automatic telemetry chatter. The flight deck picked plates were alive with columns of rushing data.
A bulk clipper of the classic Isolde pattern, from the depot yards of Urhaven, or Tancred. Majestic,
Amos was muttering, and annotating his idle observations into his wrist slate again. The SN was 3 kilometres long by my estimation, and fully 700 metres deep at its broadest part. Its nose was a long sleek cone, like a cathedral spire, made of overlapping Gothic curves and barbed with bronze finials and spines. Behind that bladed front, the angular hull thickened into muscular buttresses of rusty red plating, looped and riveted with ribs of dark steel. Crenellated tower stacks bulged from the dorsal hump. 100-metre masts stabbed forward from the hull like tusks, and other, shorter masts projected from the flanks and underside, winking with guide lights. The rear portion of the juggernaut splayed into 4 heat-blackened cones, each of which was large enough to swallow 12 gun cutters at once. Betancourt turned us in and ran us along the flank, heading aft. To us, the great vessel seemed to wallow and roll as we joined its horizontal. A lighted dot divorced itself from the SN and ran out ahead of us, flashing ultra-bright patterns of red and green lamps, a pilot drone to lead us in. Betancourt gently chased the drone and swung to port as its lights instructed. We slid neatly between 2 mast arrays, crossed the ribbed belly, and finally braked to station keeping under a rectangular belly hatch, edged with black and yellow chevrons. The hatch was one of a line of 6 down the hull's underside, but this was the only open one. A fiery orange glow washed down over us. Exchanging a few terse comments with Euclid in the drive room, Betancourt nudged the gun cutter upwards through the yawning hatch. I watched the edges of the hatch mouth, 2 metres thick and scratched in places to the bare metal, pass by alarmingly close. There followed a series of gentle shudders and mechanical thumps against the cutter's outer hull. Amber light bathed the cockpit. I looked up into the glow outside, but saw little except a suggestion of dark gantries and cargo-lifting derricks. Another shudder. Betancourt threw a row of switches, and there was a whine as power feeds and auto systems wound down. He pushed back from the control deck and began pulling on his hide gloves. He smiled at me.
"You needn't look so worried," he mocked.
In truth, I am most disquieted by things I have no control over. Though I have rudimentary skills and can manage an atmospheric craft, I am no pilot, certainly not one with Midas's Glavian pedigree. That's why I employ him, and that's why he makes it look so easy. But sometimes my face betrays the alarm I feel in situations where I have no ability. Besides, I was tired. But I knew sleep wouldn't come even if I tried, and there was business to attend to anyway. Amos, Beckwin, and Loink would stay on the cutter for now. As soon as the hull door was closed and atmosphere recirculated into the SN's hold, I opened the hatch and stepped out with Fischig and Betancourt. The hold where we were docked was vaulted and immense. I reminded myself it was just 1 of 6 accommodated by this vessel. The surfaces of the walls and decking were oily black, and sodium lighting arrays bolted to the ceiling filled the place with orange-tinted luminescence. The spaces above us were busy with the skeletal shapes of cranes and monotask lifters, all shut down and lifeless. Packing materials littered the open floor. The gun cutter was held over the sealed floor hatch in a greased crib of docking pistons and hydraulic clamps. We crossed the hold, boots ringing on the metal deck plates. It was cold, the chill of open space still lingering. Betancourt wore his usual Glavian pilot suit and garish jacket. He was cheerful and whistled tunelessly. Fischig was impassive, oozing command in his brown RBT's uniform. He had fixed his golden sun disk of office to the breast of his jacket. I wore a dark sober suit of grey wool, black boots and gloves, and a long navy blue leather coat with a high collar. I had taken a stub pistol from the weapons locker and had it in a holster rig under my left arm. My inquisitorial rosette was buttoned away inside a pocket. Unlike Fischig, I felt no need to make a statement of authority. A hatch clanked open on servos, and lights shone out from an internal companionway. A figure stepped out to meet us. "Welcome to the SN, Inquisitor," said Tobias Maxilla.